we have grown so inured to space and time and the sense that we think we know what that is, that when Einstein spoke about space and time and about the continuum that they represent, it blew a hole in scientific thinking, a gaping hole. I remember there were two German physicists. One of them, a very well-known physicist by the name of von Laue. He might have gotten a Nobel Prize. I think maybe he did. But he is on record as saying, if this new quantum physics kind of bunch of ideas turns out to have any merit at all, then I'm quitting physics. That's what he said. What? No part. Yeah, that'll show them. Right. Well, I want to say that whether it's the Ionian Enlightenment of the 6th century BCE or the European Enlightenment of the 16th and 17th centuries, or maybe 17th and 18th is a little better. Whether it's whichever one of those it is, I would say that these eruptions of new energy, spirit, and human inventiveness quite literally turned the world upside down. Our own time is really pretty calm in that regard, except if you knew what was going on in the universities and laboratories these days, I think you'd be quite astonished and perhaps fearful. You might know there's a spate of new movies about robotics. It's interesting to read the critical reviews of those movies by people who are cultural critics, who are now beginning to look at those movies as an expression of an underlying concern about what is emerging out of the vast new knowledge of material that we're acquiring, direct products of quantum science and other things. But these occasions have forever changed the ways we would see the world and ourselves in it in the future. Somewhat ominously, and I really want to stress this part, the New Order also placed the mythopoetic way of thinking in a dimmer light as a way of having and expressing access to a form of human experience. It became suddenly unfashionable and really quite non-chic to talk about mythopoetic ways of telling truth in the face of all the advancing waves of new discovery. It's true today. I can vouch for that personally, having lived in both those communities. I remember in the late 70s, I was going to New York to Joe Campbell's seminars frequently. And also, I went to have a little bit of study with a man who was studying dolphins at the time. He had a lot of notoriety. You'll remember his name before I do. I was persuaded that there was something interesting going on here, and I needed to find out what it was. This man was already thinking about intelligences other than our own on the planet and trying to get some sense of understanding of what may be going on in the deep oceans. So he was doing very creditable research in the culture of dolphins, their speech patterns and their habits. And I want to find out about that. And whales, the big whales, you know. And I came back to Wilmington, and of course, in the next week, I'd tell my colleagues at the laboratory what I've been doing. And you probably would not be surprised at how amused they were. And one guy says, "You want to know what the whales are saying?" "I know what the whales are saying. They're saying shrimp, shrimp, shrimp." But that's very characteristic of the character of the response of the community of rational thinkers to the doings and the workings of the community of mythopoetic expression. I found it to be almost universally dismissive, contemptuous, and arrogant. Oh, very good, yes. All of that. And if I were to ask you what kind of psychological mechanism is in play, what would you begin to say? What's that? Say it again.
Denial.
That? I'm thinking about the psychological mechanism that we all use from time to time to protect ourselves. Defense. Can you see that as a defense mechanism? I think I can certainly see that now. Because sometimes the criticism was always with a laugh and with a joking way. But behind it, there was an urgent feeling of, keep that stuff out of the room. You can't let that stuff in here. That stuff is not legitimate. And it's a kind of a chilling experience, actually. And when I encounter that kind of defense, or at least these days, I would say to myself, that person is feeling in some way more terrified than I at him, because he cannot entrust his construction of the world in the way he now does that to an alternative style. It's too painful, it's too dangerous, it threatens too much. It threatens psychotic disturbance, even. So, strange creatures we are. Mythological forms of truth-telling became rivals with the new scientific rationalism, and this conflict persists into the present. Now, I'm going to have to hurry on a little bit because I don't want to get too much involved in wordiness. Did a little bit of that last night. But I want to give you an example of the contrast of mythological ways or image-related ways of telling truth and what it means. Some people in this room have already heard this, so you can do whatever you want while I tell this little story. If you were to come to me on any given Friday afternoon and say, Alden, how's your week go? I'm going to say, you know, I feel this afternoon like I've been chased by a herd of angry rhinoceros this week. And you say, ah, yeah, I got it. You would know exactly what I mean, wouldn't you? And without question, you would know exactly, but there is not one truthful statement. Well, there is a truth, but it's concealed behind the image. But your mind penetrates the image immediately. And you know what I mean. And we are in sync. But there is not a factual statement in anything I've said. No facts in that statement. But it succeeds in conveying truth with an image, a picture. And we have a lot of examples of being able to talk like that. And our common language with each other is full of those things. Man, I was really beat up today. Well, where are the bruises? You know? And so forth. But you can do that with your own imagination. I will say that right now, there is an opportunity for another radical advance in human mental life. And I think this is really kind of the high water mark of what I want to say in this whole seminar, this whole conference. An opportunity for a radical advance, another one, in human mental life in the prospect. It's only a prospect being nurtured in a few places. Well, I think maybe this is one of them. In which both symbolic and rational objective thinking will complement each other. They will sleep in the same bed, married as it were. They will even enlighten each other in a new synthesis within the collective mental process. I would hold that out as a goal and as a possibility, and probably the only way that the human species will organize and integrate its competitive ways of creating the world in future. I can't even begin to wonder what it would be like if scientists would begin to be less afraid of the mythopoetical point of view. It reminds me of a story, because when I was in Zurich living there, I was still in acute withdrawal from laboratory. And I had to get a fix now and then. I went up to the ETH, the technical institution in Zurich. It's a world-class university for science. I didn't manage to get admitted to any of the groups there where I could just listen to the chemistry and get it fixed. But there was a little library down in the city of science and technology, which you had to be a member of to have access to. So I bought a little membership. That meant I could go in there in the reading room and sit and read the latest journals. That was kind of fun for a while. But then I got well. But one day, I saw a paper in a journal. And this paper was announcing the discovery of a new molecule. And it was very exciting when that happens. You know, scientists, they really get excited, unstable sometimes. And this announced the discovery of a molecule consisting of carbon atoms only, consisting only of carbon. Now, you don't find those kind of molecules in the natural world out there. Those molecules are covered with hydrogen and oxygen and nitrogen, and they're all fancy and complex. This material had 60 carbon atoms in one molecule, and that's all that was there. It was discovered, and you'll love this, in the light spectrum from stars. That's the first place this new molecule had been observed, in the radiant energy coming and creating a spectrum of a star. And there was some feeling about what the material might be, a polymer of carbon. And it was theorized that the high temperatures and perhaps high electrical discharge in planetary evolution could have had some, could be the source of that particular molecule. And to make the story short, the writer of this paper had found a way in his own laboratory to produce this new molecule by taking a rod of pure carbon and heating it to incandescence and then blasting it with an electric charge. This kicked free carbon atoms off into the away from the solid matter of the rod. And as they began to reform themselves, they formed a certain proportion of this new C60 molecule. That's what we all knew it as in the first days, C60. And since it was now possible to make trace amounts of it in laboratories here, it was possible to subject it to all kinds of measurements. And an X-ray photograph was made of this molecule. And lo and behold, it was revealed that it was a perfect sphere. Well, no, not perfect, but it was spherical, like this. 60 carbon atoms arranged in a network all around the molecule, evenly all around. C60. Well, that paper created a sensation. I knew it would. The minute I read it, I said, this is going to knock the roof off. I would say within less than a year, around the world, 2,000 to 3,000 chemists were working on C60. Soon they discovered there was a C72. And there were solid molecules looking like a wiener. I mean, as the number of carbons get bigger, it's as if nature takes this sphere and stretches it out. Those real objects exist in the universe. It was quite amazing. And the structure that they have, the C60 structure, is exactly looking like the common soccer ball. You know how the soccer ball is made of pentagons sewn together. At the intersection, the corner of each pentagon in C60, there's a carbon atom. That's what the molecule is. So seeing that from the X-ray work, people named this new material soccer balline. Later, it became named Buckminster fullerenes. You know, it looked like two geodesic domes put together. Well, that story was very thrilling, and I remember reacting to that. And it's calmed down a bit now because those things, some of them can be bought in chemical supply houses now. Anybody can study them in the laboratory. It's quite astonishing. But that was a radical advance in the chemistry of extra large molecules, which is now become commonplace. But I'm talking about a radical advance of another kind, in which we are able to bring together our capacity for symbol formation and symbol communication and symbol and picture and image understanding of the kind you had when I told you my little example. We know how to do that. But if that can be put together with the rational faculty, I can't even quite imagine how the human story will unfold after that. Well, let me go on just a little bit. Now, I think, judging from last night, I think we probably ought to stand up for 2, 3, or 4 minutes. Do you agree with that? Not right now. Let me just do. That's actually very cruel to say it and say not right now. That's stand up as interruptus is what that is. Okay. Oh, if this historical record that I've shared with you is seen as archetypal imagery for a process of revolutionary transformation that occurs always and everywhere in the individual human psyche, as well as the psychic collective, then we can imagine that there is no time in a personal lifespan when there is no hope for deep and radical psychological transformation. So I don't want to hear about how old you are or how tired you are. There's no time when this transformation cannot happen a priori. In fact, it's now indisputably clear that there are moments in a life when the psyche desires or even demands in striking ways that an old pattern die. I'm going to come back to that later. Die. And that personal consciousness be reborn in a new form. Now we are in the realm of death and rebirth. That's going to occupy us the rest of today and tomorrow for a bit. And I think this process was clearly at the heart of the encounter of Jesus with the man Nicodemus. You know that story, I think it's in John. When Nicodemus, who was a substantial Jewish member of the Jewish community, had come to this young rabbi because he'd heard some of the things he was saying and doing, and he wanted to find out a little bit more about who was this guy. After all, he was a Jew. They shared that. So what are you saying? But he was careful not to come in the daylight. He didn't want to be seen associating with this young radical. So he came at night. And he said, Rabbi, I have heard things that you have been saying, heard of them, and I've heard of some of the things you are doing. I would like to understand more about what you're about. Something like that. And Jesus responded, you have to be born from above. That is, if you want to understand what I'm saying right now, you have to be reborn from above. And Nicodemus was taken aback. And he said, oh, how is this? How can that be? Do you mean that a man has to re-enter his mother's womb and emerge again? And you can imagine Jesus rolling his eyes a little bit. Yes, but Nicodemus was a reasonable man, a rational man. But he was caught in the net of his thinking process. And what Jesus had just said was much too cryptic. You have to be born from above. And Nicodemus left. He was disappointed. He didn't get the message. What was the message? Well, for me, it is this. You will have to die to an exclusive and uncritical reliance on ordinary understanding and come alive again to a new way of thinking about and perceiving human spiritual truth. Nothing less than a metanoia, a new mindedness, will suffice for grasping the language and meanings that appear at an entirely new level of life. That's death and rebirth. And that message, that story, I have no idea if that meeting actually happened. Nicodemus appears twice more in the New Testament. He appears at the crucifixion. He is in the crowd around the cross. He's observing. You know something has caught him and will not let him go, even though he doesn't quite know how to make it work yet. And the third time he appears is when the body is removed and taken away for entombment. He assisted in that. So there was something in Nicodemus that was aroused, but he had a hard time coming to it. Well, I think we should now stand up. Thank you for your patience. Now, I'm sure of it. But don't go away, please. Stand up and stretch, and you have about 2 minutes.